Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to What Women Want with Judy Goss, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in once again to What Women Want Talk Radio. I'm Judy Goss, and I'm here with my co-host, Kristen West, whose film Seeking Valentina was just nominated a few days ago at the Hollywood Dreams International Film Festival. Congratulations, Kristen.
Thank you so much, Judy.
Oh, you're welcome. I know I threw that in. You weren't expecting it, but I'm just so proud of you.
Oh,
and we're also in the company of another superstar on our show today, NBC's Today Show's financial editor, Gene Chatsky. Gene has been talking finance for decades and has a lot of important advice. And we're going to find out where her story all started in the finance world. You'll actually be quite surprised at the answer, I think. It's amazing the backgrounds of some of our guests and how they took the paths to create their legacies and where they are today. We'll be bringing Gene on in just a few minutes. And in the meantime, I want to thank all of you out there, our listeners. We've been on for 3 years and we've hit over 800,000 downloads. Oh my gosh, but who's counting? We still get so excited every single show, and we know you do also. So if you haven't subscribed to us, please do so on iTunes or visit our archives on LA Talk Radio's website, latalkradio.com. I'd like to take a moment here to just send out my thoughts and prayers for the people suffering from Hurricane Harvey in Texas. I'm not even sure, honestly, what to say. It's really just indescribable tragedy. And I myself have been through two devastating hurricanes, Andrew and more recently Hurricane Sandy. And I can just only begin to imagine what these people are going through. And this one looks even worse. So God bless everybody out there, the first responders, the selfless people who are volunteering to save people. And it's just, you feel so helpless. Kristen, you're from Texas. Your family, everyone down there is okay. It's going to take such a long time to recover. It just kind of reverberates, you know, all through the country, really.
The people of Texas and the surrounding areas that are going to be affected by the storm are going to need support for a long time. And we need to keep in mind in our thoughts and in our words and our actions what this region of the country will need. And I think one thing that we also have to keep in mind is this storm is moving. It's moving to Louisiana. It's moving into the other states. We need to make sure that we keep the momentum going for the recovery of these areas that are affected.
That's right. And I've seen this happen where people just donate and they come out of the woodwork to volunteer and you know, drive over there. And I just, my thoughts and prayers are with everyone. I want everybody to be safe. And you know, if they say don't go in an area where you're not supposed to go, you know, please adhere to that because it can get very dangerous, those situations. So God bless everyone down there. Okay, a little bit about my background. Besides being the host of this incredibly awesome radio show, I'm also a TV lifestyle expert, a regular contributor on NBC and Fox. And I was actually just on Channel 11 down in Atlanta a few weeks ago talking about how we completely underestimate our talents and what we can do to figure that out. And I was also plugging my Spirit of Women conference down there. I'm so excited. I founded the company What Women Want Networking 6 years ago, and we're now hosting our first national conference. We have several chapters spanning from coast to coast, and we're now moving to be bigger and even more influential on a national scale. So it's very exciting. I'm also a St. Martin's Press author and a freelance writer for New York Lifestyles magazine. And my most important job is the mama of 13-year-old twins. Wow, two teenage girls in the house. Quite interesting sometimes. Now, I'm going to plug the Spirit of Women conference because, like I said, I'm just over the moon about it. We're going to have 300 women down in Atlanta at the Westin Peachtree Plaza Hotel, October 7th through 8th. It's a day and a half event. Over $4,000 value of education and coaching for less than $300 for a general admission ticket. I have a discount code, It's Judy Discount, J-U-D-Y, Discount. So go get your ticket now, spiritofwomenconference.com. We are going to rock this conference out. We only have 17 VIP tickets left, actually, and we're going to be closing that red velvet rope after we sell out, which we will, spiritofwomenconference.com. Kristen, are you joining us?
Yes, I am. I'm very,
no way.
I'm very excited.
Oh my gosh, you're going to join us between all of your red carpet ventures. I am so honored. Oh, I'm so excited.
Judy,
thank you so much for your support.
Judy, for me, this is the event of the year. I want to go to this so bad.
You are a blessing. I love you. Well, I'm going to read your intro because I'm proud to say that you are an award-winning actress, multi-award-winning actress now, screenwriter and producer. Your film, Seeking Valentina, was nominated, as I said before, for 2 awards at last week's Hollywood Dreams Film Festival in Las Vegas. A script you co-wrote called Likeness has just been nominated for a screenwriting award. Wow, you are on a roll at this year's Fantastic Horror Film Festival. And you can also be seen in the upcoming films, The Spirit Room, Hell's Kitty, and The Lich, all due out later this year. You look like you were having so much fun last week. I'm so proud of you.
It was a great time to be in Las Vegas because the title fight, the Mayweather-Conor fight, Conor McGregor fight, was going on, and there was a lot of hubbub already, and it was just great to be there in Las Vegas, experience the film festival, experience all of the excitement and all the wonderful things that Vegas has, and I always love going, especially when I get to go with great friends like Armin Nasseri and our cast and crew.
I love it. And when I'm in Las Vegas, I end up losing money and spending money. And so now our next guest is going to tell us exactly how we can kind of curb that a little bit and start to save money. And she's the expert here in the financial world. It's Jean Chatsky. She's the financial editor for NBC's Today Show. She's an award-winning personal finance journalist, AARP's personal finance ambassador, and the host of the podcast Her Money. And that is on iTunes. Jean is also a best-selling author. Her newest book, Age Proof, Living Longer Without Running Out of Money or Breaking a Hip, which she wrote with Dr. Michael Roizen, is a New York Times bestseller. In 2015, Jean teamed up with the Time for Kids and the PwC Charitable Foundation to launch Your Money, a financial literacy magazine reaching 2 million school children each month. Wow, that's fantastic. She lives with her family in Westchester County, New York. Welcome to the show, Jean.
Hi, Judy. Hi, Kristen. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You know, from an English major in college to a personal finance guru on TV, I know there's a story in there somewhere.
You know, I wanted to be a journalist, and I knew that pretty early on, but I was also a bit of a math geek in high school, and so, I mean, you'll remember this. You spent time in a lot of magazines in New York, I know. When I graduated from college, I landed a job at Working Woman magazine, which doesn't exist anymore, as the assistant to the business editor. And that was just happenstance. I mean, if the assistant to the food editor had been open, I would have applied for that job. Or
you just wanted to kind of
fashion
get
editor. I just wanted a job. I just wanted a job. And so I got this job as the assistant to the business editor, and it was a really good fit for me. I liked writing stories where numbers played a part. I liked writing stories about businesses and careers and management. I mean, this was sort of every cover that we did at Working Woman back then, and this was 1986, 1987, seemed to be about the glass ceiling in some format or other. And it was a really great training ground for me. And when I was ready to leave Working Woman, I wanted to go to a big business magazine. I was desperate to join Forbes in the fact-checking pool because I had heard that being a Forbes fact-checker was just the greatest job on earth, and you learned so much, and you would work till 2 in the morning, but you would love it.
You really were a math geek, weren't you?
I was a little bit of a math geek, and I couldn't get a job. I could not get a job at Forbes or any business magazine, because they looked at my resume and my experience and my clips, and they thought they were sort of faux business, fake business, and didn't think that I really had the chops to do it. And so I freelanced for a little while and really took a little time to think about what I wanted, and ended up applying for jobs on Wall Street. I thought about what business reporters do, and I realized it was very much what equity research analysts do on Wall Street. And on Wall Street, it was actually easier to get a job than it was in journalism, because research analysts were happy to have somebody who could write around to help them write their dozens and dozens of research reports. And so I did that job for a couple of years, and I really learned financial statements. And then I got a job in the fact-checking pool at Forbes. And from there, moved to Smart Money magazine to write about personal finance. And I've been talking and writing about personal finance ever since.
Now, I want to reiterate what you said here. Gene Chatsky could not get a job at Forbes. And that's just, you know, really illuminating for people out there to know that someone like you, when you were first starting out, went through that. And then kept going and still kept your eye on the prize and did what you had to do to build up to that. Because I think sometimes people look at someone like you and think, oh, she probably, you know, had it easy from the beginning, because you do make it look easy. I mean, you walk out on the Today Show and it's glamorous and it's, you know, you're really doing such a great job letting the world know, you know, about their finances. And it's just nice to hear that someone like you, you know, had a few curveballs and went through that sort of thing.
Well, and not just career-wise, but with my own money. So I came out of college making $11,500 a year, which was not enough, by the way, to live in New York City. So I got a little help from my parents. Thank you, Mom and Dad. And I taught SATs on the side. I mean, I had a side job because that was the only way to make it work, and ate a lot of soup from the Chinese restaurant that cost a dollar for dinner. And, you know, really did not do a very good job of managing my money. I racked up some credit card debt, a lot of credit card debt, if I'm being totally honest about it, and didn't understand what a 401k was, even though I had one. And it took me a few years of reporting on personal finance to get my own finances working. And I think that's really important to share, because nobody teaches us this stuff. But I feel like if I can do this, you know, being an English major and not coming at it with any sort of formal education other than reporting on the job, which, by the way, is an education in and of itself. I get to learn about new permutations in personal finance every day, and they continue to keep me interested. But I do think it's really important for people to know that you're not necessarily wired to do this or genetically inclined to do this. You can learn it if you want to learn it, and you can practice it if you want to practice it, and that's what it is. It's really a series of habits that you practice over and over again. And once you commit to doing that, then your financial life will work.
Gene, one of the interesting things I found out about you was that one of the people you reached out to actually suggested that you get an MBA, and you decided not to. Is that right?
Yeah. So when I first applied to Forbes, the chief of reporters told me to go get an MBA if I wanted to get a job there. And I wasn't really ready to go back to school. I loved college, but I loved the activities and the social aspect of college a lot more than I loved class. I didn't really want to go back to the classroom, and I certainly didn't want to take on the huge amount of debt that it would have cost me to go back to the classroom, because although my parents you know, put three kids through college with no student loans. I knew graduate school was on me. And so I thought about what he was really asking of me in order to get this job. And really, he said, go get an MBA. But what he meant was, you need to know how to read a balance sheet. You need to understand financial statements. You need to know how this stuff works. And I figured I could learn it on the job.
I think that's so very wise of you. I remember in the middle 2000s when people were graduating from college and the housing market was crashing and people did not know what to do. They were often going to grad school just to go to grad school to prolong the repayment of their loans because there was nowhere for them to go or they didn't know what to do.
I think my stepson just did that.
Oh my.
Well, I think people did it too. I mean, I remember doing some segments on the Today Show, helping people who went to law school during those times who then discovered that they didn't really want to be lawyers. You know, those are very expensive degrees, and I'm a big believer that it is well worth the money to go to college, and it's often worth borrowing to go to college, but it's not worth borrowing mindlessly. It's not worth, you know, you've got to think about the value proposition of whatever sort of an education you're going to take on, whether it's your four-year college degree or graduate school, and figure out if you're actually going to do the work after it to repay those loans.
One of the things I like so much about, I looked at your whole website, by the way, which everybody on the show, go to GeneChatsky.com after the broadcast and just check out the treasure.
Thank you.
Check out the treasure trove that is this website, because if you really need a good solid place to start, check it out. I really like this rule of yours that more money won't always make you more happy. Is there a balance, have you found, in consulting with people and in your own life experiences?
Yeah, and there's a ton of academic research to back this up as well. So, maybe 10 years ago now, I did a big study on money and happiness. And the basic finding was that once you had enough money to make you comfortable, not enough to live lavishly necessarily, but enough to live comfortably, enough to pay your rent or your mortgage, make your car payment, you know, put gas in the car, go out to eat once in a while, maybe take a vacation every once in a while, enjoy yourself a little bit, but not go crazy, that more money beyond that was not going to make you more happy. And what would make you happier was having a level of control over whatever money you had. And that control was pretty specific. It included being a regular saver and maintaining a moderate level of debt and doing things like paying your bills when they came in rather than saving them up in a big pile to pay once or twice a month. And a few years after that, Daniel Kahneman, who's a very famous Nobel Prize winner out of Princeton, he did a much more rigorous academic study. Mine was much more mine was a poll that we did with the folks at Roper, 5,000 of them, but still not a Daniel Kahneman level type study. But he found very much the same thing and basically put a number on it that said once you had $75,000 on average, granted, it means it's a bigger number in some parts of the country than it is in others, but more money wasn't going to make you more happy for the very same reasons.
You know, I almost had Kristen host the show by herself tonight because my family went through bankruptcy, you know, during the recession, and we just had a really hard time. Our house is on the auction block, and we just were crashing and burning with everything finance. And the one thing I noticed about, you know, just clicking around on your website was that you take tips for someone like me who's, you know, still, honestly, you know, coming out of that situation several years later. And you really break down a subject that is intimidating and can be confusing to very practical advice. Now, I want to ask how you do that, but you know, that's such a broad question. But maybe another question would be, you know, what are some of the basic pieces of advice that you have for people who are looking to kind of get ahead, but yeah. just look at the word finance and go,
I can't stand that, right?
Yeah.
And this is why, I mean, you mentioned at the top of the show that I have a podcast. It's called Her Money, and it's an ongoing weekly conversation about all this kind of stuff. It's about life, but through the window of money. And I mean, I want to actually answer your first question about how I simplify it, although I don't believe I make it simplistic. I just, early in my Today Show career, and I've been on the Today Show now for 22 years, but had to take these 8-page articles from Smart Money magazine and explain them in 3.5 minutes. And so I would go through this very, very rigorous process of breaking the stories down and figuring out what was important and writing it out longhand, and then asking myself every question I could potentially imagine that the anchors might ask me, and shortening my answers. And I used to drive myself back and forth to New York City and talk to myself in the car. This was like before everyone had a cell phone and was talking on the phone, and people in the cars next to me used to look at me like I was an, you know, crazy person, because I would be carrying on this conversation with myself.
Or an actress. But, practicing your lines.
Yeah, exactly, right? But that's sort of how I did it for me. I did it because I figured if I understood it, then everybody could understand it. And I think that's kind of true. And it's what I believe about anything financial these days. Like, you should not be giving your money to anybody who can't explain to you what they're going to be doing with it, or what it's going to be going in language that you can understand. That there's just no place for that, especially now. And I think that over time sort of helped me realize that there are really only 5 things that you have to do if you want to be successful financially. This was one of those epiphanies. I realized that I tend to have my best ideas either when I'm out for a long run without music, or when I'm in the shower. And this was one that came to me in the shower. But essentially, it's just, there are 5 things that you have to do if you want your financial life to work for you. And if you can do them with regularity, you're going to be fine. So the first one is, you have to earn money. You have to earn a decent living enough so that you can accomplish the second thing on the list, which is to spend less than you make. You got to leave yourself some room for saving. The third item on the list is that you have to take that money that you're not spending. You got to funnel it into a segregated savings account where it can help you out in an emergency. But then once you've got enough for emergencies, invest it, so that it can grow and work as hard for you as you're working for yourself. The fourth one on the list is that you have to have a protection plan in place. That includes life insurance if you have dependents. It includes health insurance for anybody. It includes a will so that if something, God forbid, were to happen to you, the people that you care about would actually be able to have access to this money that you've got for them. And the fifth one on the list, and you talked about this, Judy, at the top of the show, is you got to give back, because nothing else makes people feel as happy, as healthy, as really practicing gratitude. And I think that's something so important. We live in New York, but we spend a lot of time in New Jersey, and so we were right there with you with Superstorm Sandy, and I've been watching this coverage, and I yesterday went on the Red Cross website and made a donation, and I think anybody who has the means to do so really needs to do the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, even a few dollars, if enough people give, you know, it can make a real difference, that's for sure.
Yeah, Gina, and I would also just say, you know, I did it, and then my husband came home, and his company, he said, oh, well, my company is matching contributions. And so if I had thought to ask him, you know, because I think a lot of companies nationwide are probably doing that at this point, then I could have doubled that contribution. So if you have a member of the family that works for a major corporation, make sure you look into whether you can get matching dollars for any money that you decide to give yourself.
Jean, that's a whole segment right there.
Yeah.
You know, how people can do that. And that's very thoughtful. That gives me a few ideas, too. I want to get back to your podcast, Her Money, right?
Mm-hmm.
You had Gloria Steinem on there.
I did.
What did you guys talk about? I'm curious.
Oh, you know, we talked about the changing role of money in the lives of women through the ages. We talked about Planned Parenthood. That was on her mind that day. We talked about money and the role that it played in her life and her smart investments in Manhattan real estate. I mean, I was just, you know, I have such amazing guests on this show, women all ages, and all sorts of walks of life who tell their financial stories, because a lot of us did not grow up with a financial education and have had to learn it on the fly, Gloria Steinem being one of them. And sharing that with other women gives all of us a little more air and confidence, I think, when it comes to making the sort of financial decisions that we have to make. And you know, that's the thing. There is no getting around the fact that we as women are going to have to run our financial lives in the vast majority of cases, at least at some point in our life, even if we're not doing it now, because we outlive men, we're staying single longer, we get divorced. We have to be ready to take this on, even if we're not taking it on today, and that means getting involved in these sorts of conversations. And so that's why I started Her Money, and we're doing pretty well. We've got a nice audience. It's a mix of millennials and Xers and boomers, and we talk about everything from, you know, raising money smart kids to starting businesses to work-life balance, or whatever you want to call it, if you believe that it actually exists, to how to invest for your future.
Jean, is there a way we can better teach our younger citizens, especially our girls, to handle money better? I remember the first time I ever learned about the stock market. I was in high school economics class, and they sat us in front of a computer simulator one day, and I was very hot to trade on the commodities market. So I had a little fake money, and I was buying gold like it was going out of style. And then I didn't really have much of anything else after that. How do we teach girls, especially, to become more financially savvy?
You know, Kristen, it's so interesting that that's the example that you gave, because that's the problem, I think, with personal finance education. So much of it is wrapped up in these stock market games that don't have very much to do with the real life needs of managing your own money, which have a lot more to do with budgeting and credit and saving before you get to investing. Yes, you have to invest, and you should get in your 401k, but you should probably do it in a very boring way where you put your money in a diversified fund and you just keep contributing. So I think the very best way to teach kids how to manage money is to give kids some money to manage. I'm a big believer in allowances. I think most people don't give allowances properly. If what you're trying to teach kids is that money is a limited resource, and that they, like adults, have to make choices about where to use their resources. And so by making sure that they have some money, but they also have a list of things that you, the parent, are no longer going to pay for, where they have to decide how to allocate their money, what's worth it, what's not worth it, what's worth banking for, you know, saving for a few weeks to have enough for, what will they regret if they blow a whole week's allowance on, when is it worth it to work to have additional money to add to the money that your parents give you. My two kids at this point are, one's in college, one's out of college, and there are a lot of light bulbs that go on with an allowance, but nothing teaches a child more about money than working and earning their own.
Do you think the school children know something that older people don't? I know that, you I mean, saw this article, and I thought it was funny, because I was a millennial. I am a millennial, and it was like, how to shop.
I was going
to
say,
how to shop like a millennial. I'm like, how do I shop like me? What are they talking about? Is there something? Because the kids have more technology now in their hands than we do. Does that present certain advantages or disadvantages as things become more sophisticated?
I don't know about shopping. Although I do think, you know, millennials, like most of us these days, at least for big purchases, are very used to doing a lot of research online before we even go to a store, if we even go to a store. But I had an interesting conversation with my daughter the other day about Venmo and how easy it's made her generation. It's made the flow of funds between members of her generation become in a way that it just wasn't for us. She was at a party with a bunch of her camp friends over the summer. She was put in charge of getting bagels for the morning. There were 40 kids at this thing. They all slept over. And so she went out in the morning and she got a mess of bagels and spreads and juices and all the kind of whatever people wanted, and then she Venmo charged everybody on the party list $3, and they all paid her. And she didn't have to go around and collect. She didn't have to bug people. Those of whom I said, "What happened?" There had to be people who didn't pay you. She's like, "Yeah, I just embarrassed them online." I mean, it was a very routine transaction. No chasing people down. I do think, in some ways, the technology has definitely made it easier for them. But in other ways, I think it's made it a little harder because money is a lot more invisible than it used to be. Mm-hmm. They don't see the money flying back and forth as much as we did when we were spending cash. And we know that cash is easier to hold on to. It's easier to save when it comes to spending on plastic. It's a little too easy to spend impulsively and get in over your head. So I think it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, when I look at my wallet and it's empty, I sure as heck know the deal.
Yeah.
You know, and this brings me, actually, it's a nice segue into my next question, which is really how much of our mental awareness has to do with the amount of money that we have. Is there an association there? And if there is, I think there is. You know, how much is it?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So if I have a negative kind of attitude towards money, you know, I'm never going to make the amount of money that I thought I would make, or I keep thinking that, you know, I'm almost there, but I'm never really going to get there, or that type of thing. Do you think that has a direct effect on, you know, our really potential or the outcome of what we're going to make? Like, do you think?
Yeah,
you know,
no, I do. I mean, I think it has a direct impact, much in the same way that telling yourself you'll never be able to run a marathon has the impact of you never running a marathon. I think negative thinking doesn't help. by the same token, I'm not a big believer in the secret. You know, I don't believe that if you envision yourself wealthy, you will automatically become wealthy. I think you have to work for it. And I think that there are a number of traits that you can, I like the research, and I did another big study a few years after I did the happiness study, trying to figure out why it was that some people succeeded in all sorts of financial climates while other people got stuck or fell back. And it was in many ways a direct response to The Secret, because I was frustrated by the success of that book. It didn't really resonate with me. And what I found was there's this cocktail of both financial habits and personality traits that do enable people to succeed pretty continually. And they're things like optimism and resilience and connectedness and doing something in life where you feel like it's a calling rather than a job, as well as financial habits like saving. Saving habitually really solves so many problems. If you've got savings, then you've got a way out of a bad job or a bad relationship or a bad investment. I mean, you really can write your own ticket if you're a habitual saver. And so I don't think I can speak highly enough of that. But saving habitually, making sure that those protections are in place for you, minimizing credit card debt, combined with the personality attributes, really do put people on the road to success.
Jean, I have to ask, is there a way that you would recommend saving? I know a lot of people right now, because the interest rates and the yields on savings accounts are not what they have been in the past, they're really just either not saving, putting it off. Is there a way to do that? Should we stash it under our bed?
No.
It's not going into your Venmo account?
No. So you want some savings in cash, at least a few thousand dollars, probably a little bit more than that. And then you want to be with your long-term money in an investment portfolio, a mix of stocks and bonds that make sense for your age and your risk tolerance. And if you've got a plan like a 401k at work, you want to just be contributing to that automatically through paycheck withdrawals. If you don't have a plan at work, then you need to set one up for yourself. It can be an IRA, it can be a Roth IRA, it could be a SEP plan, which allows you to put away more each year than you can put into an IRA or a Roth. But the key is these automatic contributions, because as human beings, we're not wired to think about the future. We're wired to think about the present. And so you need to take that decision out of your day-to-day life and just make a good decision one time and let those automatic contributions, both into savings and into your investment accounts, ratchet right up. Now, the exception to the money that you want to invest is money that you do need in the short term, meaning the next few years, to pay for college or to put a down payment on a house or whatever your short term goals happen to be. Even though interest rates are frustratingly low, that money really still belongs in the bank.
I have a feeling this has a lot to do with age proof, living longer without running out of money or breaking a hip.
It does. I mean, you know, I'm
tell us about
running
your
out
book.
Of money. So this book, which came out in February, I wrote with a guy named Dr. Michael Roizen. He's the chief of wellness at the Cleveland Clinic, and he's a total rock star. And what we both realized at about the same time was that because we're living so much longer, you need both good health and financial security if you want to go the distance. And even if you've got good health, if you don't have financial security, you're not going to be able to stay healthy, and vice versa. If you've got financial security, but your health is really lousy, your finances are going to go down the drain very, very quickly. You need both, and the same strategies can get you there. So we put our heads together. We wrote this book. It's done very well. It's ended up on the bestseller list, which we're very, very grateful for. But the same strategies, things like automating, can help you improve both your health and your finances. Things like building strong teams and knowing how to substitute a better habit for a bad habit, because it's really hard to break habits. It's much easier to substitute a new one for a bad one, can really help you along the way to success.
When is it too early to make a will, or is there a signpost that you should make a will? Because I know a lot of people in my age group may have assets or something, and they don't even think about making a will because that's, you know, what older people do. Is there a signpost that you should make a will, or you should investing in life insurance?
The flashing signpost that you should make a will is having a baby.
Okay,
you know, once you've got dependents, mm-hmm. you absolutely must have a will. Before that, if you've got assets that you really care about where they end up, whether you want to make sure they end up in the hands of charity, you want to make sure they end up in the hands of maybe your siblings rather than your parents or anybody besides your spouse, then you have to make a will. And that's because if you die without a will, the state that you live in has a hierarchy where it distributes your assets. And, you know, if you're married, everything's going to go to your spouse. If you're married with kids, it'll be divided between spouse and kids. But your state will determine what happens. And you may not like that. You may not agree with that. And so having a will, which is a very easy document to write, you can do it with software like LegalZoom or WillMaker. It is pretty much a no-brainer.
Yeah, no, it's there are so many resources out there today that, you know, with what we can do. And again, you have a way of breaking it all down and motivating us too to kind of get going and do that. Now, I like to tell people where they can listen to your podcast, Her Money. When does it air? Where can we go?
Oh, thank you. So you can find it anywhere you find podcasts, basically. So iTunes, which I think is now called Apple Music, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Her Money with Jean Chatsky is up there. But people can also go to my website and subscribe on my website to Her Money. We also have a weekly free newsletter, and I would love it if your listeners would tune in. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, I was impressed with the range of guests that you have on there, you know, and the range of topics. So it looks like a fascinating show. Out of curiosity, just on a personal note, what is your most favorite topic to talk about besides the obviously the broad financial spectrum? What is your favorite aspect of the financial world for you to either do a segment on or talk about on your podcast, that type of thing?
So my favorite segment of our podcast is our mailbag, where we answer questions from our listeners. We get a ton of them, and I really like that. But in terms of the overall world of personal finance, I really like the behavioral stuff. There's a lot of research these days into why we do things with our money, even when we know they're the wrong things to do. And I think that's so fascinating, that look into human nature really, really interests me.
Yeah, me too. It's always fascinating. I studied psychology a little bit in college, and it's always fascinating to me, you know, why people do what they do. It's constant, and it's also a journalist thing too. I mean, you have an endless curiosity of, you know, why people act and what they do and where it leads to.
Is there a question that comes up over and over and over again?
There are a few, actually. How can I find somebody that I trust to help me with my money? How do I teach my kids about money? Do I need long-term care insurance? I mean, those are some of the biggies. What's the best way to pay off my student loan debt?
I can imagine,
if you don't have money.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, no. And so how do you find someone that you can trust? What are the top tips that we can give listeners out there?
I like to start much in the same way that you would look for a doctor. I mean, ask people who you trust, who they work with. It's best to ask people who are in a similar financial situation to you, so maybe colleagues rather than friends. You come up with a short list of people, you call them, look into their backgrounds a little bit. There's a tool called Broker Check from FINRA that you can use to check the backgrounds of people. And then you sit down with three or four people that you think might be workable for you, and you have a conversation with them about their process. How do they work with people? Do they handle just one aspect of your financial life? Some advisors are more focused on tax or insurance or investments, or are they holistic and they deal with your entire financial picture? That's my preference, by the way. How much do they cost? How much is it going to cost you to work with them? And you want to try to get it down to a dollar figure so that you can compare apples to apples, because advisors get paid in different ways. And then I would just really pay attention to the tenor of the conversation. So if you're sitting down with a new advisor, they should be spending most of the time asking questions of you. They should be trying to learn about what you need and what you want and what you want your money to do for you, and whether they can actually do that job, rather than trying to sell you on their track record or how their return on investment or their stellar list of clients or, you know, anything else. If they're talking more than they're listening, that is a really, really worrisome sign to me.
That's great advice.
And then I would just do a gut check. I mean, I think you should be able to be really open and honest with whoever you hire to do this sort of a job for you. And if you're feeling, for whatever reason, like you can't talk to this person, then they're not the right person.
So basically, do your research, take your time to interview them, and get referrals. That
yep.
sounds like, with you know, the three top points.
Anything, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, so JeanChatsky.com, like Kristen said, go on the website, because there is so much great stuff on there, including the podcast and blogs and where to get her book and everything. And Jean, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was just such an enlightening conversation. And like I said, I'm just so impressed with the way you break things down for people and just spin it out there in a very positive way.
Oh, well, thank you, Judy. Thank you, Kristen. It was fun.
Oh, my gosh. It's our pleasure. So, Kristen, are you interviewing me next week?
That's the rumor I hear at LA Talk Radio, is that we're going to have special guest Judy Goss on next week, which is going to be a lively interview.
Oh, my gosh. Is this another one of Matt's girls things?
Well, it may be. It may be.
So, you know, I'm going to be on the show with Marie Frattoni. She is the founder of Get Clients Everywhere. She's based in Atlanta, where I'm having my women's conference in October, The Spirit of Women. And we're going to dissect what exactly the spirit of a woman means and how it can lead you to success farther and faster than you ever imagined. So thank you for listening, everyone, and have a great night.
Listening to What Women Want with Judy Goss, only on LA Talk Radio.